meeting to order and note for the record that a quorum is present. And the first order of business today is the approval of the minutes from Monday, January 23rd. Vice Chair Edelson, do I have a motion to approve?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. And with that, members, I'll just give you a little bit of a roadmap for today. We have a pretty full agenda and we hope to get through this in our normal committee time, but if we need to, we can go a little bit over before the room is reserved. But the hope is to process these bills prior to going to the floor so that we do not have to come back tonight. So, and with that, our first bill on the agenda is House File 28, the Right to Vote Restored. So welcome to the committee, Representative Frazier. And I will have Representative Freiberg make a motion that House File 28 be re-referred to the General Register.
So moved.
Thank you. So with that, Representative Frazier, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, leads, thank you for having me here this morning. Mm-hmm. House File 28 does essentially one thing. It restores the right to vote to those individuals that are no longer currently incarcerated, individuals that are back in their communities, individuals that are working jobs, that are paying taxes, helping take care of their families. But the one thing they're missing, as we've already deemed them safe to be back in the community, the one thing they're missing is their ability to fully participate in our electoral process. House File 28 does just that. This bill has been around for almost a decade, or a little bit longer than a decade. I think it's finally time that we get this done and give their, it's about over 50,000 individual Minnesotans that have this right that has been taken away from them and are not fully able to participate in our electoral process, and I think it's time that we give that right back to them. I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Frazier, and I'll note that the fiscal note is in our packet, and that is why we're here today. Any discussion to House File 28? Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Frazier. So it looks like this bill would restore the right to vote for those that haven't finished their sentence but are out on parole. Is that correct?
Representative Frazier.
Representative Petersburg, that is absolutely correct. Thank you for that.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to just clarify, so basically what you're saying is that if they were to have been incarcerated for their full term, they wouldn't have had that right to vote. But because the system was lenient in giving them an opportunity to get out of jail, the right to vote should be given to them. Is that not really unfair to those that are still incarcerated but would have been eligible for vote to a parole? It just seems like it's inconsistent to the rationale and the reason for having sentencing and sentences for those that commit crimes.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Petersburg, what I am saying is that we have deemed these individuals to be safe enough to be returned to the community. What I'm saying is that when we do that, as part of the redemptive and restorative process, we're also saying that we've deemed you to be safely back in the community. We're also deeming you to be a full participant within the community, and that includes restoring your right to vote, to participate in the democratic process, and decide who will represent you in our democracy.
Representative Petersburg.
I would just follow up with a comment that's saying, you know, sometimes the consequences of our actions do have consequences, and this is, I think, one of those issues where we appreciate that they're working towards that, but we have to be very careful to make sure that we appropriately apply it across the board, and I think this is one of those areas that maybe we've a little overstepped ourselves. Thank you.
Further discussion to Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Frazier, for bringing this bill. This is something that we discussed fully in the Public Safety Committee, and one of the things we've been looking at in that committee is also how inconsistent practices are. I remember in 2019, a woman came in and had a 40-year probation sentence for drug offenses. So we don't have consistency around the state in that. I think this is a really good bill. I also really appreciated the letter of support we had from victim advocacy organizations representing victims in every single corner of this state in full support of this bill. So thank you so much for bringing it.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Frazier, there's several other constitutional rights that you lose when you're convicted of a felony, and Are those going to be restored too? Or any other particular constitutional rights that you lose that you feel should be reestablished?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Novotny, this bill only deals with restoring the right to vote.
Representative Novotny.
And thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Frazier. But as I said, if this is important and it's disenfranchising that some people lose their rights when, depending on where you live, where the crime is committed, that they might get one sentence executed on them that would not be the same sentence in a different part of the state. Do you think that's fundamentally fair?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Novotny, I'm not sure if I understand your question.
Well, we have.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Frazier, there are several parts of the state where we have seen massive downward departures from presumptive sentences compared to other parts of the state. Same criminal penalties, same criminal conviction, resulting in great disparities in the sentencing. Is that fair?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Vodney, I'm still not sure I understand your question, but I will say there are huge disparities within the way our sentencing happen within this state. I am working on a bill for data collection. I believe you're interested in data collection, and I hope we can work together on that to actually pinpoint and figure out policies we can put in place to cure those disparities.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. I am aware of that bill, and I would like to work on you with that bill because I think it's very important information if we're going to treat Minnesota fairly and have, as I've said in previous committees, you know, a victim of a crime in one part of the county should get the same justice as a victim in a different county or a different part of the state. So thank you, Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Frazier.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Frazier, what happens if they become a recidivist and go back in?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nash, they lose the right to vote.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Frazier, I agree that it would be I think you would receive a fair amount of bipartisan support to look at some reform for probation. Would rather have gone down that road because, and I've said this in the Public Safety Committee, but as you walk out the door of prison, I'm not sure that that is exactly the time that most Minnesotans believe that it is time to have those rights restored. I do believe that most people believe that probation is not the worst thing in the world, and that having certain rights not yet restored are not an outrageous thought. So I'll be voting no, and we've had this conversation before, but I just think that it would be better to pursue some reform. And I think, you know, I've talked about it with Representative Mueller, talked about it with Representative Pinto, I've talked about it with other people, how being on paper for 40 years, I can see that there's an argument to be made there. But I do believe that there is a reason to not have voting rights yet restored until that probation period is met. So perhaps I'm a little old-fashioned. Many have accused me of such. But I do believe that looking at the reform of the probation length would be a better way to do this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for bringing this forward, Representative Frazier. This was the first bill we heard in the Elections Committee, and I was proud to make it that. I think this is something that's long overdue. We heard really compelling testimony from a variety of people just about how this will help them integrate back into society. I mean, if we trust people to be working in the community, hopefully they're paying taxes, we should trust them to have a say in their government as well. It's the clear trend nationally to allow people on probation to vote. In the last 3 years, Nevada, Colorado, New Jersey, Connecticut, New York, and Washington restored voting rights to citizens on parole. There was an executive order in Wyoming. It's passed by initiative in states that allow it, in states like California and Florida. This is the trend states are moving. I think this is the direction Minnesota should move as well, and I'm happy to support this bill.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Were there any others on the list? I'd be glad to go last.
Do you want to, I can ask though, is there going to be any other discussion? Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Rep. Frazier, for this bill. This is a long overdue bill. I'm a woman of faith, and I know many of you guys are, and I believe in redemption. I also believe in second chances, and this bill gives people second chances to be integrated into society, to have a right to have a say in government. Just because you made an error a lifetime ago, that does not mean that you lost the right to vote forever. So thank you for this bill, and I'll be voting yes.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Olson. I have just a couple questions for the author, and then I'll just have a closing comment or two. Representative Frazier, so what happens if someone has had this right restored and they're out on probation and they violate the terms of the parole? Are they still able to vote?
Representative Frazier.
If those individuals are reincarcerated, they lose the right to vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so if they violate the terms of their parole but they are not sent back, they I just want members to know that they still get the right to vote. There was a question asked, Madam Chair, in the Judiciary Committee, and we didn't have an answer to it, and I don't know if an answer has been found. But we were curious if a person that's on this sex offender registry would still remain on the sex offender registry if this bill would be implemented. And do we know an answer to that question?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scott, I don't recall that question, but this bill does not deal with removing individuals from the sex offender registry.
And Representative Scott and I will we'll take some leeway here to do things that were done in other committee, but you know it's here for the fiscal impact.
Sure.
So, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was a question in Judiciary, and they were still trying to find it out. But I would just urge members to vote no on this. If you think it's okay for sex offenders who haven't fulfilled their entire sentence to be awarded with the right to vote, and others that have committed crimes against persons, and you think it's okay for them to have the right to vote. If it were my daughter that had been raped, I don't think I'd be okay with that. So, members, I encourage a no vote.
I don't see any further discussion, so I'm going to give Representative Frazier the last word.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to the last point that Representative Scott made as the last speaker there. There were victims that testified during the movement of this bill through committee. One victim that specifically testified to the fact that they had experienced a sexual assault. And they talked about restoration, and they talked about redemption, and they talked about the reason why they thought those rights should be restored so that individual could be repaired and move back successfully back into the community. Victims are not a monolith. It would be unfortunate if anything would happen to your daughter, but victims are not a monolith. And a crime that is that happens, and for individuals that when it's happened in their past and we've deemed them to be safety back in the community, I think we should restore that right to revote. Data shows that when individuals have their rights restored, that they are more engaged in the community and they're less likely to reoffend. And that is what we should be moving toward, and that's one of the most important things for us. We're talking about public safety. That's our job, to keep communities safe. That will help communities remain safe and be safe and stable. You know, we talked about, Representative Hassan talked about her faith. There's been tons of individuals that have come up from the faith community to testify in support of this bill. I remember the first hearing, an individual from Red Wing came up during a snowstorm as pastor, and she talked about, and this statement stays with me, she says, restored people restore communities. And that's why this bill is important. We want to make sure we restore individuals so they can pour back into their communities with goodwill and good faith and restore those communities. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Frazier, and thank you for bringing the bill forward. Representative Freiberg, would you renew your motion that House File 28 be re-referred to the General Register?
Yes.
All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no.
No. No.
The motion prevails and House File 28 is re-referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Frazier. And members, I will just note that I told a few of you offline, but that we are going to move the agenda around slightly, and House File 19 will be the last bill on the agenda for today. And so we're going to go in order other than that. So the next bill will be House File 5, Representative Jordan. So welcome to the committee, Representative Jordan. We're very glad you're here. And I will have Rep. Joachim make the motion that House File 5 be re-referred to the General Register. Is that your motion, Representative?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's my motion.
Wonderful. Thank you. So welcome, Representative Jordan, and please proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. When one in six Minnesota children is trying to learn on an empty stomach, it is far past time for us to act. And that's why I'm honored to present House File 5, a bill to bring breakfast and lunch to all Minnesota students. We know hunger is something that too many students bring with them, and our system is letting kids go hungry. Not only do one in six Minnesota students experience hunger in schools, but one in four students experiencing food insecurity come from families who do not qualify for existing nutrition programs in our schools. So here's what House File 5 does. This bill establishes no-cost breakfast and lunch for all students attending schools participating in the National School Lunch Program. It also enrolls qualifying schools into the Federal Community Eligibility Program, or CEP. You might also hear some advocates refer to it as SEPs. CEP is a federal program that provides universal, no-cost meals at schools in high-poverty neighborhoods where many students come from families eligible for SNAP and other assistance programs. This bill also appropriates money to MDE to get going on the setup and administration for this year. The fiscal note for House File 5 is based on the average number of students who served in 2018 and 2019. District data related to school meals has been more inconsistent due to the pandemic. And MDE projects that the total cost for providing school lunch and breakfast in 2024 will be $189.7 million. The fiscal note assumes a 4% annual growth in the number of students served, which would increase costs in fiscal year 25, 26, and 27. MDE also projects it will incur about $200,000 each year, starting in fiscal year 2024 for 1.5 FTEs, which will be nutrition program consultants, plus another $90,000 in IT costs for fiscal year 24. The appropriations in this bill reflect the fiscal note, but also include $400,000 to MDE in fiscal year 23 so it can get schools prepared for the start of the school year. The total amount appropriated in fiscal year 23 and 25 matches the projected costs for 24 and 25. And so members, now is the time for House File 5. Schools are no longer receiving resources that they need for meals from the federal government like they did during the pandemic. Student lunch debt is racking up across the state, and families struggling with the high cost of food need these meals now. I also have staff from House Fiscal and MDE Assistant Commissioner Darren Cordy. And with that, Madam Chair, I stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Jordan, and thank you for walking over a little bit of the fiscal note. We appreciate that, too. So discussion to House File 5. Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Jordan, for bringing the bill forward. Did you mention the total cost, just to make sure we're on agreement on the numbers? So what is the total cost for 24 and 25?
Representative Jordan, and we do have the fiscal note in our packet that is updated to reflect the current bill. Representative Jordan.
Yep, it will be $387 million from the general fund in fiscal year 24 and 25, and $419 million in fiscal year 26 and 27.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Jordan, I don't see him in the pack yet. Do we have district runs available?
Representative Jordan.
Madam Chair, Representative Kreshaw, those have not been produced yet.
Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Jordan. So just short comments on this. We heard this in Ed Finance. No district runs yet, which means we don't really know the impact to our local schools. A couple of things in consideration of this. What you're trying to accomplish with making sure that we have universal access to meals is agreed. Students should have access to meals, and they should have that at an affordable rate. The problem is we're creating a government program here to do that, and the issues that I've identified and brought up in education finance and for ways and means that we should look at is because we're creating a government program, a state government, if you look on page 2, lines 2.19 through 2.27, what we're trying to do here, as I understand it, is we're trying to make sure we maximize the CEP provisions, and we're forcing schools to fill out paperwork so that they can get access to that. And I appreciate that we're trying to buy that down, but one of the things that we're trying to do is reduce the free and reduced forms. It seems like we're putting more burdens on the schools to do this. That may be fine, and the schools may want to do that, but we should just acknowledge that because we're creating a school government program, we are creating more work on the backs of the schools, and we're actually making this, in my opinion, a bit more complicated. Because, as testified here, we have student debt, we've heard shaming, we've heard reduce the point of sales. The reality is none of that will be addressed in this bill, because this does not address a la carte lines. This gives one student the access to one breakfast and one lunch. If a student decides to go back, they will still have to pay for that. So schools are still going to be burdened with collections. The reality is some people don't pay their bills, and we acknowledge that, and there is a debt that schools end up with a collection. I think a better proposed solution would be to put the 441 or the 387 or the 419 right on the formula and then let schools buy down the debt. I think when we see the school runs, what we're going to see is we've created a state program that puts a whole bunch of money into the school universal programs, and that money cannot go out. Once it goes into the school lunch fund, or once it goes into the nutrition fund, it cannot come the other way out. So in other words, a school district like a couple of schools that I talked to over the last couple of weeks, they're only carrying like $15,000 or $20,000 in unpaid debt. And they're going to see a large amount of money higher than that that they cannot move out for teacher programs, teacher pay. We're going to see an unequal distribution of state aid on this. And I think that's the danger of this. What you're trying to accomplish, Representative Jordan, I fully acknowledge that we should take the schools out of collection. And I think, as I've offered in education finance, and I'd be happy to come back with it, why don't we just allow schools to submit their debt, we pay that down, and then put the rest on the formula so that, like I said, we could increase teachers' pay, we could stop the schools from, and teachers from having to feel like they have to buy their own classroom supplies. So I would not support this as it is. I think it's a program where we're trying to solve a mosquito problem with a very big state program that I think, and I hope this isn't the case, and I hope it's successful, but I think that as we run this through, we're going to see scenarios where there will be a misappropriation of funds. There will be funds that the allocations will be higher in schools that they shouldn't be, and that's problematic for me. So at this point, members and Representative Jordan, I would not recommend voting for this bill.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Chair Olson, and I also want to acknowledge how long Representative Jordan's been working on this issue since she first came to the legislature. It really was brought to our attention during the pandemic for a lot of folks who maybe weren't paying attention, but Representative Jordan's really been our champion on this even before that time. And just wanted to respond to a couple things. As far as creating a government program, kids already eat at school. If you have school-age kids, they eat at school right now. And the other thing we know is that during the pandemic, when it was paid for across the board, the sky didn't fall. Kids got food, and actually the kids who, when my kids were learning from home, our school used those funds to put together, you could go get a box of food, and those lines were always, people needed the food. And it was put to good use. And I think as far as concerns about forcing schools to do paperwork, what do you think the forms are that everyone's supposed to fill out every single year? It's paperwork, and I know it's especially burdensome for folks who don't speak English as a first language, for folks who are really struggling, working multiple jobs, like asking them to fill out an extra government federal form is a lot of work. Ultimately, I just don't understand why this there's any disagreement about this issue. When folks in other countries need our help, when there are disasters like hurricanes, what's the first thing we do? We give people shelter and we feed them. And at a base level, if our government can't make sure that our children are fed, I mean, this should absolutely be a priority, and I'm just really happy that we're bringing it forward. We're making a priority for, you know, early on in session, because ultimately we should be able to agree on making sure our kids have food. And then the other thing I just wanted to touch on too, you know, I know there's been some discussion in the other committees about like, oh, but what if like a wealthy person, their kid gets like $1.75 breakfast? Well, in other areas, we're fine with giving breaks to wealthy families. I don't know why when it comes to like a $3 lunch, we would be concerned about that. So I just think this is a really good bill and happy to be a co-author and really glad that we're moving forward. So thank you, Representative Jordan.
And we have quite a few members on the list, which is great, but we have Nash, Joaquin, Petersburg, and Scott, and hopefully after that we'll be able to move on with the bill too. So Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would make the comment to my colleague on the other side of the aisle, no one's saying that this is a bad idea, and when we ask questions, it doesn't mean that we think it's a bad idea. We're asking questions about the mechanics of some of this stuff. And I remember when I was a freshman, my friend and our former colleague, Representative Sarah Anderson, was leading the charge on some of these very same things. So please don't misconstrue questions about the mechanics of this bill with us opposing it necessarily. So my question to the author, Madam Chair, is Representative Jordan, you articulated some IT costs, and yet I don't see them spelled out in the bill. Can you help me understand what those are and how that is to be paid for either from the state or by the independent school districts?
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Nash. I am looking for the page on the fiscal note, but I do know that MDE is requesting $90,000 for IT costs, and is also requesting an additional $400,000 for administrative costs to really kick the tires on some of those IT concerns and get the program set up with schools to get going. And that money can be used for this year for the setup, but also transfer into 2024 for that. And if you give me a second, I will find the... Yep, it is on page 3. And the second paragraph indicates some of the tech costs and data collection that would go into that. So that would be the paragraph that explains the IT costs.
Representative Jordan, and I will note there are appropriations in the bill that match the fiscal note as well. So Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And to the author, are those costs all state? Is some of that going to be pushed down to independent school districts that they'll have to levy for, or is that taken care of?
Representative Jordan.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, there are some of the local fiscal impacts that are considered within the fiscal note are costs that schools would have to incur to modify their point of service tracking systems. So that is money that would go in, and if Assistant Commissioner Cordy would like to correct me, that money is appropriated directly for MDE and Minute to do their end of the IT work.
Looks like we have someone from the Department of Education coming up to answer the question. So welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your answer to the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Darren Cordy. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Education. Representative Nash, the funding that's appropriated for IT costs in this bill does go to MDE. It would not go to districts, but the per meal funding reimbursement structure is intended to fund the total cost of the program, not just the cost of the actual food being served. So schools could certainly use some of the extra reimbursement that is generated through state funds here to cover the costs of those IT or point of service upgrades that they may need to do as a result of this bill.
Representative Nash.
Last question, Madam Chair. And that all sounds interesting, but I also know that with the cost of inflation, food's going to be going up, and that there may not be any money left over for them to handle this back office IT work. IT costs money. And pushing it down to the district level is going to be a little clunky, I think. And I will just say this before I finish. During the pandemic, I watched the school districts that are in my district. They stepped up. It was great. They fed anybody who showed up, and I was proud to watch it happen. So once again, please don't construe how we vote with anything other than that we have questions and are not exactly convinced on how this bill rolls out. I have questions. We'll bring it to the floor, since I'm sure Madam Chair would like to continue moving along. I could feel her eyes even without looking over, but I just think that there's some problems here. I am concerned that we're pushing some of these costs down to the district level without any way to pay for them. As we all know, those are called unfunded mandates. Thank you.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And once again, I want to just thank Representative Jordan for all the work she's done on this. I rarely see a legislator that knows her bill backwards and forwards like you do, and I really appreciate it, especially the fiscal note. There's a lot of good details on fiscal notes if folks read them. And I wanted to just maybe clarify, too, one of the reasons why we're doing this is we've done it before. We did this during COVID. Districts have the capability of doing this. Districts have asked for it to be simpler, getting rid of the forms and streamlining. And I think the administrative costs that they've been going through collecting all these forms and doing this detailed work will more than be made up for with the money we're putting into feeding all kids. One of the reasons why it's harder to detangle, detangle how some folks have suggested that we should just increase the income level or do this or do that. It's not just the CEP program that districts that have 62.5% of kiddos that qualify for free and reduced lunch receive. Our federal school lunch program is also subsidized for portions of meals for all children. So you can't really kind of pick and choose that way and have districts be able to actually implement it. It's just much easier and cleaner to do it this way. And I am glad we're asking detailed questions, and a lot of those detailed questions were discussed in the committees as it moved along where it should be. And I understand folks have been talking to their school districts who have come out and said this is the way they like to do it as well. And just remember, your vote is your voice.
Representative Petersburg.
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. And, I think we need to remember that a bill that we think is good, if it's based upon incorrect assumptions, probably isn't the best bill that we could do. And I think there are some misconceptions and certainly misperceptions out there. For example, we just heard the assumption that all children eat school meals at school. Well, that's just not true. I know that I have kids that do not particularly like meals sometimes, and so they will pack their own lunch or they will do something different. And I think that's an issue for us to remember, that this isn't a universal across the board. But if I could ask the author just one quick question, Madam Chair. The question is it a fair statement to say that if a school district is expected to pay to create food and lunches and breakfasts for the entire student body, that they will provide the proper amount of food that would feed all of them? Is that a fair statement?
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And there are, that's not a, just to be clear, that's not an assumption that this bill is based off of. This bill is not, does not assume that every student will consume one breakfast and one lunch from their school district. In fact, the reimbursement, it's a reimbursement. So schools will only be reimbursed for the meals that are actually served. And so this bill would provide one breakfast and one lunch that meet the federal and state nutrition guidelines to each student that requests one. If a student comes in with their own lunch and they're not served a lunch, they would not be, this district would not be charged for that lunch. And there would not be a reimbursement for meals that were not served, if that makes sense. And so that is the assumption that the costs are based off of. And the costs and time do take into consideration some increase in uptake in the free program, but it is not based on the assumption that every child is receiving one breakfast and one lunch. And to the question about what would the meals be and how much would they would be meals that would fit the federal and state guidelines for school meals. I don't have it in front of me, but there's a long list of regulations that schools must adhere to if they participate in the federal school meals program. It includes things like how much calcium is in a meal? Is there milk provided? What are the amounts of added sugar are just some of them. And so that does deal with portion size. But if a student would, for example, want two lunches, that student and their family would be on the hook for the second meal. But this would provide the one breakfast and one lunch.
Representative Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. I think you just actually made my point. Because the fact that the reimbursement and so forth occurs after the meals are prepared and after the kids have gone through line, schools just absolutely don't know who's going to not need the meal and who isn't. So they're going to have a tendency to create the meals that are necessary for the children, which is going to lead to waste. You know, when you say, well, if they don't eat the meal, then they don't get reimbursed. Well, that's well and good, but I don't think any school district is going to ask at 8 o'clock in the morning, hey, how many students here are going to eat and how many aren't? That seems a little bit silly. So my only concern is that we have created a much bigger headache than the current system rather than dealing with a much straightforward way. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Jordan, for bringing this bill forward. You know, we're talking about our kids. I've got four kids in the school district. Every kid is different. And quite frankly, this is something we need to be talking about and supporting all kids no matter where they come from. And this is not a mosquito problem, Madam Chair. This is about our kids. I want people to know this is not a mosquito problem. With that, I would like to ask for a roll call, Madam Chair.
A roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call on House File 5. And we still have more discussion, so we'll finish up here. Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, I think Representative Prisha said it for our team as our lead on education. Thank you.
Okay, and we will give Representative Jordan the last word. And I will say, just as someone who's chaired Ways and Means, I don't think there has been a member who has been in my office more than Representative Jordan, who knows her bill and has a really solid fiscal note and has been working very hard on making this right. And it's based in, you have a great fiscal note, and I hope all members read it and honor the work that you have done for the last many, many years to get this bill here. And so it is based in good information and good data and working with the department. And with that, Representative Jordan, last word before we go to a vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for the discussion. Happy to answer questions. But this bill is fundamentally a bill that puts students and their needs first. We know that the way students interact with school has lasting impacts for the rest of their lives, and food is one of those most elemental issues that I've heard from students and adults that really matter. We heard from the American Diabetes Association about how this is important for students' physical health. We heard from children about how this is important for students' mental health. And we've heard from students themselves in committee about how addressing mental health, addressing the achievement gap, addressing disparities between white students and students of color can be addressed with this bill. So I do ask for member support. This is a bill that is important for healthy and happy families across our state. Thank you.
Thank you. A roll call has been requested. Clerk will take the roll.
Chair Olson?
Aye. I pause on the roll call. I wanted to make sure we renew the motion that House File 5 be re-referred to the General Register, and that was Representative Joachim's motion, and that is the motion we are voting for. Yes. Clerk will take the roll.
Chair Olson, aye. Vice Chair Edelson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edelson, aye. Lead Garofalo, excused. Representative Akam?
Aye.
Akam, aye. Representative Egbaje?
Aye.
Egbaje, aye. Representative Becker-Finn?
Aye.
Becker-Finn, aye. Representative Freiberg?
Aye.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Gomez, excused. Representative Hassan?
Aye.
Hassan, aye. Representative Heintzman?
No.
Heintzman, nay. Representative Hornstein?
Aye.
Hornstein, aye. Representative Howard?
Aye.
Howard, aye. Representative Cleavorn?
Cleavorn, aye.
Cleavorn, aye. Representative Crenshaw?
Crenshaw, no.
Crenshaw, no. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Lilly?
Aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Moeller?
Aye.
Moeller, aye. Representative Nash?
No.
Nash, no. Representative Knorr?
Aye.
Knorr, aye. Representative Novotny?
Novotny,
no. Representative O'Neill, excused. Representative Pulowski?
Pulowski, aye.
Pulowski, aye. Representative Petersburg?
No.
Petersburg, no. Representative Barr?
Barr, no.
Barr, no. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Schumacher?
No.
Schumacher, no. Representative Scott?
No.
Scott, no. Representative Joachim?
Aye.
Joachim, aye. Madam Chair, there are 17 ayes, 8 nays, and 3 excused.
There being 17 ayes, 8 nays, and 3 excused, the motion prevails, and House File 5 has been re-referred to the General Register. The next bill on the calendar for the day is House File 213, Representative Keeler. Welcome to the committee, Representative Keeler. Representative Pinto, would you like to motion that House File 213 be re-referred to the General Register?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Keeler, welcome to the committee, and go ahead with your presentation of House File 213.
Good morning, Chair and members. To follow up with what Representative Jordan just talked about, we're talking about food insecurities around Minnesota. I have been serving in food shelves for close to 30 years. When my kid was born, by the time he was one, he was serving alongside me. Food shelves are in all of our communities. All of our constituents utilize this. What this bill does is very simple. It's utilizing funds that we have, $5 million to support the gaps that we have to continue the support that we have for food shelves. It's a $5 million ask. Has bipartisan support. I think it's important that all of us, and we all agree that feeding our communities is really important. I'm willing to bet that all of us did something around food this morning as we plan this week, as we plan today, because we know that when we're hungry, we're hangry, and when we're hangry, we don't make the best decisions that we can. And so really, it's just feeding the foundation of Minnesota just for a time frame. If we don't move this, we have food shelves that are going to have to close down as early as March.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. And I'll no fiscal note needed because the appropriation in the bill is pretty straightforward. And with that, discussion to House File 213. With Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree. Food shelves are important. How is this money to be distributed amongst the food shelves that we have in our state?
So,
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nash. The way that it works is this funding goes directly to, it's allocated to Hunger Solutions, and then they send it out based on the need that they know within their supports.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know this, so it's not a gotcha question, but does every food shelf in the state know about Hunger Solutions, and is Hunger Solutions going to take some of this money and make sure that they do, perhaps? Because I have several in my district, and I don't know if they do or they don't know about them, but I'm just making sure that from a mechanical perspective that we've made any food shelf aware of their ability to apply for this money.
Representative Keeler.
Chair Olson, Representative Nash, if you have food shelves in your program that are doing anything around food, they absolutely know about these opportunities. We have them, they're all over the state. And again, this is a program that's been utilized for over 20 years. So to me, it's something that's foundationally been working. And if they don't, I am sure there are people here who would love to help your food shelves get involved.
Madam Chair, thank you. And again, I should have asked my wife. She volunteers at our local food shelf, but just want to make sure that we're doing our level best. If we're going to appropriate state money, that we're making sure that everybody who runs a food shelf knows about this.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thanks, Chair Olson, and thank you, Representative Keeler, for bringing this forward. Quick Google, literally while Representative Nash was talking, Hunger Solutions is the only statewide anti-hunger organization whose services reach every county in Minnesota. So I think that absolutely, if we're going to work on getting food out to our communities and out to our people, that this seems like the best way, since they're all the only ones already doing it. So thank you, Representative Keeler, for bringing this forward.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks so much, Representative Keeler, for advancing this. And I guess I just wanted to highlight how this is an opportunity. We have a forecasted budget surplus. We have people hungry today, right? Like last night, tonight, every day. And just the idea that that you working with Hunger Solutions identified that we can actually meet that extremely basic need right now, I think is just terrific. And I'm so glad that that you brought this to the Children and Families Committee, and we're moving it today. So thanks so much, Madam Chair.
Further discussion to House File 213. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Keeler, for the bill. It's very much needed, and as we know, our future economy is a little bit in question right now, and so there may be more people that are going to be needing to access these local food shelves. And so I appreciate the bill. Encourage a yes vote.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Further discussion? All right, Representative Keeler, last word on your bill.
Thank you, Chair and members, and thank you for the agreement that feeding Minnesota is extremely important. It's how we really grow and thrive here to be the best that each of us can be. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Pinto, would you renew your motion that House File 213 be re-referred to the general rep?
I do so renew it, Madam Chair.
Wonderful. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say nay.
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 213 has been re-referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Keeler. The next bill on the calendar for the day is House File 121. Let the Vice Chair make her way to the testifier table. From that perspective, Representative Edison. Being you're on the committee, would you like to motion that House File 121 be re-referred to the General Register?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would like to move that.
Great. So your bill is before us. Proceed to presenting House File 121.
All right. Well, Madam Chair and members, House File 121 is that infamous bill that we passed in the last 3 to 5 minutes of session that I worked on, I would say, for a very long time with Representative Albright. Oh. And of course, with all of those big sort of bills, we have a few technical changes, but we forgot one really important thing, which the bill mostly does, and I would like to draw your attention to that, is it appropriates in 2023 $250,000. We need to have that those funds in order to appoint the board, for the governor to appoint the board, in order to hire the executive director, and in order to hire the navigators that our state so critically needs. The other really important thing that I just want to be able to discuss really quickly is that we change restoration to attainment in many of the places, because restoration assumes that you've already attained competency at some point. We have many of our community members in the state of Minnesota that have not had that, so there's clarification on that. But I will tell you, I have county attorneys, I have NAMI in the audience here if members have questions, and judges are really looking. This law takes place in July of this year. So our counties in our state and our courts, they are ready to start using these navigators, so we need to get to work on this. Happy to take members' questions, Madam Chair.
Discussion to House File 213. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Edelson, for working on this legislation. And I work on this a little bit around the fringes following the news stories that I think it was Carrie Levin that did a series on these folks that are kind of falling through the cracks. And I'm not sure what we did last year and with this bill that it really addresses some of those people. This is a really broad and deep problem that needs to be addressed to make sure that our streets are safer. And so this members, this is pretty much a technical fixed bill, and I would encourage a yes vote.
Thank you. Representative Edelson, last word.
I will just ask for your support, and this is a nice looking committee from my view and over here. that's all I have.
All right, great. Vice Chair Edelson, would you renew your motion that House File 121 be re-referred to the General Register?
Yes, Madam Chair. That's my motion.
All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, please say nay. The motion prevails, and House File 121 has been re-referred to the General Register. And with that, I am going to pass the gavel off to Vice Chair Edelson as I move to House File 19.
The final bill on the agenda today is House File 19, Earn Safe, or Sick and Safe Time. Chair Olson, would you like to motion that File 19 be re-referred to the General Register?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And Chair Olson, you have an author's amendment, the A19. Would you like to move the amendments before speaking to your bill?
Yes, I would, please, Madam Chair.
All right. And with that, so I also understand you have an oral amendment, so maybe let's move that first.
Yes.
And maybe would you like House Research to explain that, Mr. Sullivan?
Thank you. Yes, that would be great if Mr. Sullivan could do the oral amendment to the A19.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Sullivan.
Madam Chair and members, the oral amendment to the A19 amendment is on page 3, line 8, delete 2024, and insert 2025. And with this change, then the $494,000 appropriation to the Supreme Court would match the fiscal note.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Vice Chair, or in this case, Chair Allison. Just a question to probably the author or House fiscal staff. Is this because we're expecting a lot more litigation in the courts?
Chair Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will just explain where this came from. So you were on the Judiciary Committee. You heard the bill last week. And so this was actually, we needed to make a change based on nonpartisan research caught something that we needed to fix in Ways and Means regarding the appropriation we did in Judiciary for the courts. And they could certainly explain. I think we might have nonpartisan staff if we did get into that. And so this is based on the fiscal note assumption, which I will say that is one part of the fiscal note that I personally had a little bit of issue with, that they didn't take into account the learning in all of the cities where we have seen it. They just kind of did a blanket. We'll need to have this much more going to the courts to have another judge added, which is what we're doing here. But this actually came from nonpartisan research after the appropriation was made in Judiciary. And then Mr. Sullivan could speak to the date catch more specifically, but that's the substance of what we're talking about in amending with that oral change.
Representative Scott, would you like to hear from Mr. Sullivan?
Thank you.
Mr. Sullivan.
Madam Chair and members, I would just note that the date change, the Supreme Court anticipates costs in the second year, fiscal year 2025. As drafted currently, the author's amendment would place that appropriation in 2024. My colleague, Mr. Johnson, is at the table, and Ms. Roberts is here as well, if you'd like more about the fiscal note and why it indicates there would be costs in this.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, and members, the fiscal note that triggered the amendment that was added on in Judiciary did indicate that the additional costs to the courts would begin in fiscal year 25. The change in the amendment was necessary because the fiscal note indicated that there was a $1,000 cost in fiscal year 24 related to posting notices, and then the new judicial unit would begin in fiscal year 25. There's a required statutory change anytime the legislature adds a judge to any of the judicial districts. And so this amendment added in the statutory reference, which is section 2.722, which begins at page 2, line 4 of the amendment. You can see that there is an additional judge now in the 9th district, which is down at line 2.28.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Scott, do you have a follow-up?
No, I don't.
Okay. All right. So to the oral amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The oral amendment is adopted. Representative Olson, now as amended with the oral amendment, do you want to speak to the A19?
I'm happy to do that, or I'm happy to do it in my overview if we adopt the amendment first.
I think that should be fine, Representative. So all those in favor of the A19 say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. All right. Representative Scott, you have the... Oh, sorry, Madam Chair, to your bill as amended.
Thank you. And I have done this bill a few times, and all of you have heard it a few times. We probably could just go straight to amendments, but I would be happy to walk through why I am here in the Ways and Means Committee. So Minnesotans care for one another, and we want Minnesota to be a caring state where all families can be healthy and safe. And I'm bringing this bill up today.
because we all know that everyone gets sick, regardless of how long they've been working for their employer and whether they're full-time or part-time, or even the size of their employer. The pandemic was another reminder that when people get sick, they should be able to stay home, not just for their own health or that of a loved one, but for the health of all of us. This bill would ensure Minnesota is a state where, regardless of the color of your skin, your income, or where you work, you can be there when your sick kid needs you, where you can go to the doctor before your illness goes from bad to worse, where you can take time to recover from an illness or seek support in the wake of a sexual assault without worrying about missing a bill or losing your job. Unfortunately, for far too many, especially those we called essential during the pandemic, this isn't the Minnesota they experience. An estimated 36% of working people, that's about 932 Minnesotans, don't have any paid sick and safe time. This means that in a state with the second most Fortune 500 companies per capita, more than a third of working people in our state face a terrible choice between caring for themselves or a loved one in need and the loss of wages or even the loss of employment, because in many circumstances, it is still legal for workers to be fired for needing to take time off to care for themselves or a loved one. And we know this is also a public health issue, since many employees least likely to have paid sick time work in jobs such as food service, where choosing to come to work sick can have a real health implication for the general public. And make no mistake, study after study shows that workers who have only unpaid or no sick time are significantly more likely to go to work when they're sick and pass their illness to coworkers and customers. And I'd like to cover the question of cost to employers, which has come up in the past hearings to more than a little confusion. The simplest answer is that according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics in their quarterly national compensation survey of employer costs for employee compensation, employers in our region who offer this benefit report that the average cost of providing paid sick time to employees was less than just 0.75%, which is 0.75% of total labor costs prior to the pandemic. And even during the pandemic, that only went up 0.9% to 0.9% of total compensation. For a full-time worker, that comes out to be between 15 and 19 hours of sick time used per year on average, nowhere near the maximum annual accrual rate of 48 hours. Why is that? Well, according to the research I mentioned, as well as many other studies, employees simply don't use every hour of sick time they earn as they earn it. They appreciate the security of knowing they can bank it for when they need it to care for themselves or loved ones. And the costs to employers don't even take into account the savings they see when they do offer earned sick and safe time. Businesses that provide earned sick and safe time report less employee turnover, meaning lower training costs, less spreading of illness to customers or even other coworkers, meaning less absenteeism, lower employer health care costs through better use of preventative care, and lower presenteeism or coming to work sick, all of which means higher productivity, fewer workplace injuries, and a healthier Minnesota. And for small businesses, this legislation also levels the playing field. Many small businesses offer paid sick days throughout Minnesota because they know it's the right thing to do for their employees, their customers, and their communities. But those small businesses are often competing with big box stores and large out-of-state employers that haven't offered the same benefit, all while reaping record profits during the pandemic. This bill levels the playing field by ensuring that all employers provide this basic standard to Minnesota workers. And ultimately, this bill is about becoming the kind of caring state that I think we all want Minnesota to be. As for the appropriations in Article 3 of the bill, the total is $5,178,000. I have it written out, which is never, don't do that, just to actually have the number. $5,178,000 in the coming biennium, which includes $1,445,000 in fiscal year 24 and $2,209,000 in fiscal year 25 for the Department of Labor and Industry to fund education and outreach to staff in fiscal year 24 to develop trainings and materials to ensure that employers, employees, and HR companies are ready for the start of earned sick and safe time. Investigators and administrative support staff, one-time rulemaking costs and updates to existing labor standards case management system. Then we have the time card and HR system updates of $18,000 in fiscal year 24 for updates in the House and $17,000 for the rest of state government. There's $3,000 is appropriated to MMB and $1,000 to the courts in fiscal year 24 for printing costs to meet the notice and posting requirements for all state employees, plus $3,000 for MMB in future years for ongoing payroll services covering the entire state. There's $127,000 in fiscal year 24 for replacement of staffing at the state's 24/7 operations, with the base for fiscal year 25 being $261,000. There is $494,000 appropriated in fiscal year 25 with an ongoing base of $461,000 for one additional district court judge, which we just described a little bit about, the court reporter, and the law clerk for possible private rights of action. And finally, based on best practices learned from other states and localities, including Minneapolis, $300,000 in each fiscal year is appropriated for grants to community organizations due to education and outreach workers. And with that, that is the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know you've been carrying this bill since I've been at the legislature, so thank you for all your work. We do have some amendments. Representative Scott, I'm not sure if you want to take out the A-17 first. Would you like to move your amendment, Representative Scott?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would like to move the A-17.
All right. To your amendments.
Thank you. What this amendment would do, members, is it would revert to current law on the penalties. I just believe in this bill that the penalties are extremely harsh. Last night we had friends over. They own two independent small businesses, and I was trying to explain to them this bill and the paid family leave bill, and you know, they have a small number of employees at each of their businesses, most of which are part-time employees, and the penalties, I feel, for trying to implement a brand new program like this and trying to keep all of that straight, I just feel like it's not giving any grace to employers to try to get up to speed, especially a small independent business with a handful of employees. You know, these people are very busy people. They put a lot of time and work into their businesses, and I just don't feel like the penalties in this bill are giving them a fair shake to implement a new program like this. So I would encourage members' support.
Chair Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott. So I know we've had a lot of discussion over the various committee stops, but I do want to point to a couple of things. I would respectfully ask for a no vote, and here's why. So if you look on page 12 and 13 of the bill, the kind of the sections that we're describing where we have the fees that would go up to, I want to note a couple pieces of language in this. We have it up to language. It doesn't mean it's an automatic $10,000 fine. And for the first instance, it's failure to submit or deliver records as requested. So it's not that you made a mistake. It's the first time you're implementing an earned sick and safe time policy and you made a mistake. This is about the Department of Labor has asked for you to turn over something and you have not done that, and you could be issued an up to fine. Secondly, if you read on lines 12.24, 25, and 26 of the bill, it talks about how for DLI to even issue a fine, that they would determine the amount of fine based on the appropriateness of such a penalty to the size of the employer's business and the gravity of the violation. And so we're talking about, like, DLI is really going out of their way not to assess these large fines. And in the second instance, on page 13 of the bill, it talks about you would be another reason you could have this up to, again, fine is due to repeatedly or willfully violating law. The goal is compliance. The goal is not issuing massive fines. It's really to get people to comply. And again, in that section of the bill, when we talk about the up to fine, we also have that language that in determining the penalty in this subdivision, they would take into account the employer's business. So again, if it's a small business, and the gravity of the violation. And I will note in the fiscal note on page 11, if you look, it says, and it's under the penalty section, second paragraph, on average, the department assessed and collected a penalty in 1.9% of all investigations. So DLI is not, this is, the goal is compliance, and as you've seen in all of their past investigations, only 1.9 have they even issued a penalty fee, let alone the maximum amount. So for those reasons, I would respectfully ask for to vote down the A17 amendment.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Olson, I understand all of that. So given everything that you just said, I'm still not understanding why the penalty, you believe that the penalty needed to be expanded tenfold. If there's such a low number of folks that aren't complying now, why take such a harsh step to penalize employers?
Chair Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And DLI has testified in other committees that this is a way to make sure the penalty is, as we've all noted, we're noting this $10,000 penalty, right? So it's a way to have compliance, to see the penalty as enough that someone would want to avoid it.
Representative Scott, and then I have another representative
sure,
on the list.
Thank you for that, Madam Chair, and thank you for Representative Olson. Well, why not just expand it two or threefold? Why tenfold? I do they do this in other areas, Dolly, for compliance?
Chair Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do believe so, yes.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering if the bill's author could cite those areas where they charge a $10,000 fine for something like this or turning in paperwork from an employer.
Thank you, Representative Scott. And Chair Olson, would you like to follow up with Representative Scott offline? I think that might be helpful. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just as I'm looking at this, I mean, if we're talking about the maximum penalty, and as Chair Olson pointed out, the appropriateness of the penalty, the size of the business, the gravity of the violation, et cetera, considered, we really have to think about the most egregious circumstance. So we're talking about a circumstance where an employer is just completely, just the absolute maximum circumstance. And I have to say that a $2,000 or $3,000 fine in a circumstance where that employer is repeatedly, willfully, just it's an extremely grave circumstance, a very large employer, that I do think that a $2,000 or $3,000 penalty, I'm not sure sort of what that situation is at that point. It does make sense that if in the most extreme circumstance, because this is actually an up to, could be as low as $25, $50, $100, $1,000, but in the most extreme circumstance, so I am supportive of this, and I think it makes sense based on the logic the Chair has provided. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Scott, to final word, and then let's get to the vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, the language of this bill is being changed to say the commissioner may fine the employer up to $1,000 to up to $10,000 for each failure to submit or deliver records as required by this section. I just think it's a gigantic hammer, particularly for our small businesses who are going to be trying to get up to speed on a brand new program, many of which have never seen they've not had to comply with a program like this before. I just feel like it's a gigantic hammer on our small and our small and medium-sized businesses in particular, and so I would encourage a yes vote.
Right, members, to the A17, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
The motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Representative Scott, your A21.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What this amendment would do is it would apply only to full-time employees and 40 or less employees in regard to the unpaid leave. So I would encourage member support.
Representative Olson, do you have comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would ask for a no vote on the A21. Our goal is to cover all employees in the state of Minnesota. It doesn't matter if you work at a part-time job. It doesn't matter if you work at an employer that is you know, two people or 500, we want to make sure that our workforce is covered. And if we limit this to full-time employers, then we're really taking out a big chunk of the workforce that most needs this. It's women, it's people of color, it's low-wage workers, it's people in our state. And I think not only for themselves, with that, you know, they go to work sick. We've seen all the studies. People will go to work sick. But not only that, I was thinking about it with a sick kid this week, is like, are, you know, what class of worker do we want to get a call from their school and say, I'm not going to go pick up my kid in the nurse's office because I'm a part-time employee, or I'm work for a business that's got three people? That's a terrible feeling. And I don't think we want everybody to have this benefit for the health of their families, for the health of our communities. And so in this amendment would eliminate about 36% of the workforce if adopted. And our goal is to actually cover more people. So I ask for a no vote on the A21.
Thank you, Chair Olson. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To frame this, the author has her threshold at 80 hours a year, if I read that right. If you do the math and you divide that by 52 weeks in a year, they are working for 1.53 hours a week to get this benefit. 1.53 hours per week is very little time, and I have to think that the back office paperwork in order to do all, there she is, all the work that is created for the compliance of this is more than the business owner is having imparted upon them to them by the work being done by the employee, and is surpassed also by what the employee is being paid. 80 hours a year for that business is literally, it's 1.53 hours a week. Now, I've heard of part-time jobs, but that is a whole new thing for me. So I think that this is a reasonable amendment, and I would vote yes.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Chair. And I was going to save some of this till the end, but I think it's applicable to this amendment. So I am the small business owner that we're talking about, and none of my employees are full-time. They're all part-time. It's a coffee shop. It's a service industry job. I absolutely need two of them to be there at all times. I have people who are on call, folks who don't work a regular schedule. Maybe 1 week they end up doing 10 hours, and then they don't help out until someone gets sick and we need the coverage, and they step up and help. And that's actually what we want. And I think the other thing I wanted to point out was the accrual of the sick and safe time is commensurate to the hours worked. So if you're that person who only works that amount of time per week where it's not regular, the amount of time you're going to have accrued is not going to be at a full, you know, it's not like you're getting 3 weeks of pay. It's commensurate to the hours worked. So if you're the person who's working 30 hours a week, then you're going to accrue it faster than someone who maybe picks up a shift here and there. But I mean, that's the reality of what small businesses deal with. And I'll just be honest, even as an attorney and a legislator, starting a small business was very hard. There are a lot of things that you have to keep track of. And this isn't actually overwhelming to me at all. I mean, we're already interacting with these kinds of systems in all kinds of different ways with government to make sure that we're staying up to speed with everything and making sure that we're compliant. And actually, as we were sitting here, as she was presenting the bill, I got a text from one of my employees that she has COVID. And that employee is, you know, doesn't have other income and works, you know, part-time 15 hours a week for me. And that's exactly the kind of person we want to make sure that when something comes up, when COVID happens, either way, I don't have the employee there. But to be able to give this benefit and to know that small businesses who are choosing to do this are not at a disadvantage by spending the amount of money that it takes to do this compared to some larger business that might have all kinds of income and be able to handle $10,000 or even more money than that. I think this is more than reasonable. I have already started implementing this in my business, even with being a brand new business and being really close to the margins and all those things and those people, those micro businesses that we talk about, like that's what I'm doing. And this isn't that hard. It is not that onerous. And, you know, the idea that you have to be full-time or that 40 employees is a lot. That is a lot of employees. So we would not be covering many Minnesotans who could benefit from this and really should be benefiting from this, because I don't want people coming to work sick, and I don't think anyone else does either. So I oppose the amendment and think this is a really good bill we should all be supporting as it is in front of us. Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca Finn. All right, Representative Petersburg, you and then Representative Scott, if you could do the final words so we could take a vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, one of the things we heard from the author, thank you, Madam Chair, for this bill, is her use of percentages as to how many people it would be and what kind of percentage of the cost it would be. And you know, that's exactly how actuaries use and develop their pools for determining what the cost is of any particular benefit, life insurance, health insurance, et cetera. And I think you're absolutely right. A larger big box that has a lot of overhead costs and so forth, it's really easy to absorb this. But when you start talking about the small employers, job providers that are providing jobs for part-time people, that percentage grows as to the cost of that product. I know I was at an event this past week in which a person who has part-time employees said if this was implemented, he just doesn't have the overhead, he doesn't have the profit margin to be able to allow people to have paid time off or part-time. He said he doesn't have a problem with giving them the flexible time and then for them to come in at a different time to make up what the work is done, but to pay them twice for doing the same job is very difficult for him, and he says he will probably end up not being able to hire the people for it. I don't think that's the direction you want to go with this bill, and I think that's very important. I know that if I was, as an individual, hired somebody to mow lawn and they said they couldn't do it, but still wanted me to pay them for it, I think I would have a question about that too. The point isn't about whether or not people need to be compensated for the work that they do. It's about whether or not there is enough money in the budget and in the profit and in the cost of producing whatever it is that you're providing service for in order to compensate that for it. So I think this is a realistic amendment, and I have one similar to it later, and I just think it's appropriate for us to understand that as you have lower number of employees and lower number of full-time employees, the cost actually goes up. It's not as low as what you said. So I would ask a yes vote.
Representative Scott, final word on the A21.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is 40 employees, as Representative Chair Becker Finn stated. In FMLA, it's 50. And during COVID, the relief that was given out from the federal government and the allowances there was 50 employees and over. So I don't think this is unreasonable, and I would encourage a yes vote.
So before the committee is A21, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
The motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Representative Scott, the A22.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this amendment is very reasonable. It just states that 90 days before an employee could tap into those benefits. They would have to be an employee 3 months, basically, before these benefits would be available to them, and I encourage a yes vote.
Chair Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would ask for a no vote on the A22. Since this bill passed off the House floor last year, several other states have actually passed this, have passed earned sick and safe time legislation, and what we have learned is that they're actually eliminating any waiting period. So states that were early adopters of this or local municipalities, they're eliminating waiting periods, and that's the way we're going, because we know that it doesn't matter if it's your first day on the job or if it's, you know, however long, you know, we all get sick and we want people to be able to use this benefit as soon as they can accrue it. But I will say, kind of going back to Representative Nash, is this is an accrued benefit, and you would have to, you're working one, so you would have to work, a full-time worker would take 6 weeks to accrue a single day of sick time. So you'd be working 6 weeks full-time before you could even take one day off. So we want people to start being able to accrue it right away. We want them to be able to use that benefit because people get sick. You don't know on a calendar when you're going to get sick, and this is falling in line with what we're learning nationally, and the sky is not falling in the places where this has been implemented. And I, sorry, one more thing. I will say back to the small business part, too, that I did want to say is that I'm from Duluth. Obviously, most everybody knows that. We have earned sick and safe time. We're a border city. We have lots of small businesses, and they're doing really well, and in previous committees have testified in support and have had multiple letters of support for the bill as written, and so therefore I ask for a no vote on the A22.
Any further discussion on the A22? All right, seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
No.
All right, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Representative Petersburg, you have the A12.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is similar to one other one that Representative Scott has. So I'm not going to belabor the point, and I don't expect it to be moved on. But we just heard from Representative Becker Finn that currently businesses have the option of doing this already. So this isn't something that isn't possible for employers to do. My big concern with not only this amendment but the bill is the fact that we are trying to get in the middle of employer-employee relations, and that it's important for us to know that as competition for jobs, as competition for employees occur, some of these things are going to work themselves out, and we need to help and get out of the way so that they can actually do that. Nothing in current law precludes any business from giving this option already, as Representative Becker Finn has already stated. And so therefore it's important for us to maintain some sort of hands off from government rather than always trying to be the sledgehammer of pushing some of these programs. So I would recommend a yes for this vote, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Charleston.
Thank you. I'd ask for a no vote on the A12 because this is going to take away the benefit for part-time workers. And I just want to remind people who part-time workers are in our state. They are the most likely to lack access to earned sick and safe time. They are women and people of color, and they are at the very industries dealing with the public, like food service. And so they are the exact people we want covered in this bill, and I would say a no vote on the A12, please.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A12 signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, say nay.
No.
The motion does not prevail, and the amendment is not adopted. It looks like that is all the amendments. Now to discuss the discussion around the underlying bill. Representative Kreshaw.
Just a quick one, and this is actually a side note to you. Representative Becker-Finn, you mentioned you have a coffee shop. I come in on Mondays. I always like good coffee. Where is the coffee shop? I love
Madam Chair.
Representative Becker-Finn.
We're actually trying to go mobile in the future so that we may be able to be better caffeinated over here. It's in Roseville, but thank you for asking.
So Representative Kreshaw. No Monday coffee, or I can't get Monday coffee in my way.
We'll work on it.
Very good.
I sent some cold brew coming soon. Any further discussion on the underlying on the bill? All right. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Olson. You know, this has been quite a discussion, and quite honestly, I wish I could be more excited. Another member was texting me a minute ago and said, "Can't you look happy even once today in committee?" And quite honestly, this is the kind of legislation that puts me in a really sour mood. Yeah, I know. I saw a lot of snickers over the course of the discussion and throughout the process today, but this is something that will really have a negative impact on small business. And I'll just give a few examples in my community, you know, some statistics. I represent the Brainerd Lakes area. I have one of the very largest chambers of commerce in the entire state, 1,000 members in the Brainerd Chamber of Commerce. This is a world that I live on a personal level. And we offered a number of very reasonable amendments today. Amendments that would have given them, like for example, the less than 50 employees, the federal exemption found in the Federal Family and Market Leave Act and in the Federal Families First Response Act for coronavirus. We suggested 40 maybe be a threshold, not quite to the federal level, but that was rejected today. And looking across the table, seeing the smiles as that was rejected, that's really hard. That's really hard, folks, because as Representative Becker Finn suggested, starting a business is hard. Keeping a business going is really hard. And this is going to hurt my businesses. It's not funny. It's not a laughing matter for them. And I hope that this legislation would maybe potentially move through the process and adjustments would be made to help those people. Right now we have a job market that gives employees a lot of opportunity, and they can, you know, basically have their pick. It's not always that way. And when jobs go away, and it's tough to find a job, these are the kinds of things that state government is proposing this legislative session, that Democrats are proposing this legislative cycle, that is going to hurt those small businesses, and those jobs could potentially be going away. And so I hope that my friends on the other side of the aisle would take this more seriously. That's my comment.
Any further discussion? Chair Olson, final comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for the discussion. And Representative Heintzman, your passion for the businesses, and I would say that's the passion I'm bringing for workers, and we're bringing for workers in this bill. I know too many stories of people who, having carried this bill for a number of years, who didn't have this benefit to great consequence. And on the flip side, I represent a district, for any of you who have come to and gone to Canal Park, have gone to Lincoln Park, have come to West Duluth, you are seeing a booming, thriving economy in West Duluth because of our small businesses who have this benefit. And a number of them attributed to being able to weather the pandemic because of having earned sick and safe time in our community. So the good news is we can do both. We can take care of our workers, we can take care of our small businesses, and we can do this through this legislation and create a Minnesota to be a caring, wonderful state that we all know it can and should be. And so with that, members, I ask for your support.
So Chair Olson, would you like to renew your motion that House Bill 19 as amended be referred to the General Register?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay.
No.
The motion prevails. Members, there being no further business in front of the committee, we are adjourned.